But I just can't keep from crying sometimes. And my heart's full of sorrow, and my heart's full of tears.
Good afternoon. You're listening to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. My name is Ashley David, and you're tuned in to the Living Writers Show. My guest today is poet Sean Norton, and we'll be discussing, among other things, his first book of poems, Bad with Faces. Welcome.
Thank you.
It's really great to have you here today. Well, let's take a little journey and let's start with the book. If you'll, we'll just hop right in, and if you'll read for us the poem Puckered and Shook on Lower Haight Street, then we'll get on the way.
Okay, this is a slightly long poem, so. Puckered and Shook on Lower Haight. The room we fell into was the one in which we slept on one mattress, four of us. One guy wore his army boots to bed, and for that matter all his clothes, so he could get up at 5 and walk out the door to work. He worked, as we all did, at a health food store, whose produce was often no different than the Safeways across the street, except a dollar more a bunch or pound. My boss's name was Edward. He was an alcoholic but fair, and that he had hired me with blue hair, no references, a nervous stutter. He soon proved an oaf. He would say, "Be back in a minute," then call 3 hours later. A Knob Hill bar surrounded him like a warm bath. It slurred his words. He said, "If my wife calls, tell her I went to the bank, but it would be 8 p.m. on a Sunday." When he never showed, I'd get out the padlock, chains, and close up. Back at home, I found the boy who slept in his clothes reeling in a corner. When I propped him up, he said that he had eaten off a plate on which Jim, our fried hippie friend, had cut up some acid. We stayed up most of the night, almost staring at each other. He was looking blankly at the cream-colored wall. I was looking out the window at a single street light. I'd look away for 15 minutes and then look back and ask him a question, "What is going on outside?" Then I'd look to see. At around 3, someone else came home and looked in and asked what happened. "I dosed him," I said, "laced his peanut butter sandwich." For a second, the dose kid's face puckered and shook, and he seemed to almost believe what I'd said, and admitted later that's what caused him to lunge and hug me. His depth perception must have been off, because he launched into me without thought of the wall, its meticulous cream, and his head smashed into it. I was so surprised that I almost didn't notice the blood from my nose that covered my shirt, from where his shoulder cut across my face as he performed his albatross flight. "Enough," the newcomer in the hall said, and went to shave his head. Jim came in and told me to snort some vitamin E, or was it Daniel, another fried hippie just in from Marin? It wasn't Punk Daniel, the other Dan. He was always out till dawn. Back in 1990, the Gulf War was starting up or being planned, so each morning after the guy got up to go to work, Punk Daniel would rush in and from the living room start playing "Praise God" and "Pass the Ammunition," making us get up to thrash about the room. These were our calisthenics. Later, when I moved up north, I heard from a friend about some guy called Punk Dan because he was present at every show. A month or two later, he drowned at night in a small Oregon lake when he fell out of a boat. I didn't ever stop to think there may have been a service. It seemed less absurd to think Dan was at the bottom of a forest lake or bog, nightly becoming petrified, than to imagine a man had to strip off his boots and kilt and slip him transmogrified into a suit for parishioners. For who? It was these small details that we had no idea of in regards to each other, who each belonged to. One day, right after I heard we were in the same town again, I'd found him at an outdoor concert dancing on top of a trash can. He was bone thin and had a permanent shake to him, but he remembered me fine and wanted to be remembered to everyone else. Where they were, I had no guess. That was also fine. He wanted to talk about the day he was followed in for morning exercises by the house cat, who promptly began spilling kittens in a wavy line on the floor. We had done our best to guide her into the closet and to lay her down on a t-shirt. Someone had searched the hall, finding a few more, and we put their moist bodies with the others against her tender belly. We all got home around the same time that night and stood before the closet without a door, an otherwise empty space, and quietly looked down on the image of the mother and children. She had eaten a few of them during the day. We agreed, though, that she was probably done, and as a matter of course decided not to prevent the others from sleeping on.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Tom.
Now, the reason I asked you to read that first one is that there seems to be a tension in the book between this notion of sleeping on and then journey. There's literal journey. The book takes place in many different places, and within poems, there are different places. And in that poem, there's the Lower Haight in San Francisco, and then Oregon, and then the promise of more. And I wonder, you mentioned in your biography, little biographical blurb on the back of the book, that after several false starts at different schools, you ended up at the University of Oregon. And I'm wondering if you could talk about how this notion of journey plays into your work and the poems in this book.
Specifically, well, first I can talk about that poem in terms of, I guess, waywardness and journey and sort of the implications of that. The subject of that, it did borrow somewhat from being in Oregon and a pit stop in San Francisco. I actually lived in San Francisco for a little over a year in a different and no less precarious living situation to what's described in the poem. And the living situation in the poem was actually a friend of mine. And so when I went to visit him, sort of starting off a trek of leaving one of those schools that you mentioned and ending up in San Francisco, I sort of stayed at his house for a couple of weeks. And a lot of the material from the poem comes from those 2 weeks, although I portrayed it as if I was one of the members of the house. So I think in writing about journeying or sort of waywardness, it's somewhat easier for me to distance myself from my own facts of that process and try to catch some of the emotional reality of that, but using the facts of other people's lives, if they're similar enough that I can sort of co-opt them and make them mine. But that's, I guess, specifically with that poem. In general, throughout the book, I guess, journeying, it's interesting to me to sort of take these leaps of probability in a lot of the poems and then sort of come back to some sort of groundedness. And I guess in the Puckard and Chick poem, the groundedness is just in sort of the ennui or sadness of there being no one else sort of watching out for these punk guys, except for themselves, and the only mother that sort of seems to approach a reality in the poem is this one that sort of consumes her young. So there's, you know, there's obviously dangers to sort of dangerous things out there in the waters, I guess, is part of the precariousness of any type of journeying.
And what's your relationship to this precariousness? You've mentioned in an interview I read, I believe it was in the Ann Arbor News, that there's this sort of spiraling out, journeying out, and then grounding with the domestic or the home. How do this home where that's described in the poem there is a bit of a nutty home.
Right, yeah.
In fact, where the only mother represented consumes her young. So how do you then find in the work and the places to ground the precariousness of the journey?
Where do I try to ground the poems? I guess practically in practical terms, in the writing of the poems, I always remember something that Robert Haas said about sort of fabricating a type of chaos. It was, I think, right after he was named Poet Laureate, and there was something on PBS, and you saw him at home sort of chopping up celery and being very domestic with his wife and his kids. And had that sort of groundedness, and so he was able to sort of keep the chaos going in his poems, or sort of that, I guess, again, that term journeying of sorts in the poems. But in the topic of each individual poem, I guess I always try to ground things in the idea that there's always some place to stand. There's never really a total loss of ground beneath one's feet. And so that sort of knowing that, allows me to think, at least for the speakers in my poems, that they can take wild liberties of thought or imagination, of course, and still always know that there's always something to land on, albeit sometimes really humorously or even precariously in that regard. But
and you use humor a lot in the book to do that. That shows up quite a bit. I'm wondering, in your own journey as a poet, so this theme of journey plays out in the book, but the theme of journey sort of plays out in your own life as well. And I'm wondering how you have sort of come to this moment of your first book. It's a very exciting moment. The book came out last spring.
Right, yeah, last March. I guess there's a couple different ways to answer that. I have so many backlog of so many years of sort of backlogging poems, and I was always a horrible, this might be a different topic altogether, but I was always a horrible reviser of poems, and so I think that probably lended itself to this notion of a wayward journey of sorts, because I just have tons of material that I never went back and sort of compiled in any sensible fashion. And in fact, when I was going through the MFA program here at Michigan, Alice Fulton paid me the compliment that in 18 years of teaching, I gave her the most stuff to read. So you can interpret that however you wish. But so for me, it was somewhat difficult to actually think of things in terms of a book. I think when I started writing, I even had going back to my teenage years, or early on in college, I had a difficult time even thinking of things specifically as poems. I had this somewhat fanciful notion that one was sort of a fiction writer, poet, and philosopher, and, you know, there was a sort of, I don't know, even know where I got it from, but this sort of notion that that's what one would set out to do. And so I, you know, was an 18-year-old trying to think of when would I write my book of aphorisms, you know, and stuff like that. So I actually had a realistic notion of what a book was, a book of poems could be or was, until relatively recently. So it was a very fruitful project for me in many ways to sort of think, well, I've got to call some of these poems into the book, and I've got to get rid of a ton that don't fit into like a general theme that I can imagine as a book, I guess.
Well, great. Well, we're going to take a short musical break, and then we'll be right back to talk a little bit more about some of those things. Listening to The Living Writers Show on WCBN FM. My name's Ashley David. My guest today is Sean Norton, and we're discussing his first book of poems, Bad With Faces, just out last March. And in fact, you're going to be reading tonight.
I am, reading at Shaman Drum at 7 p.m.
Wonderful. That's Shaman Drum on State Street. If you haven't been there, check it out this evening, and they have readings many nights during the week, so... Wonderful. Well, you mentioned Alice Fulton as one of your teachers. You said you gave her the most stuff she's ever received in 18 years of teaching, which I think is just fabulous. And I found on the web an interview, or rather a bit that she wrote about the final discussion of your MFA thesis.
Oh, okay.
It was from an old blog, no?
I think, is this from Story Magazine from Italy? I think there was.
This is a blog called Dumb Foundry.
Okay, well, maybe I'll jump in and
yeah, please do.
And let you know what it was.
Do.
Okay. I think what this is that she was given the project, as were hundreds of different writers and artists around the world, from this Italian magazine. This Italian magazine gave them the project of, at a certain specific time of day, on this one specific day, everybody had to record what was going on for that 10 minutes.
Gotcha. That's in fact what this is, because it's 600 seconds or something like that comes up. Yeah, 600 seconds, 10 minutes at Cafe Zola.
That just happened to correspond with our last thesis meeting, so I was lucky to sneak into that same journal that I think like Thurston Moore and some of my other heroes have appeared in. So, yeah, I was happy with that.
Good company to keep. Well, in this, you ask her a question about style, and you ask her, she reports that you do anyway, in this highly stylized
I'll disown it if it's not what you wanted.
But your question was, must style develop naturally, or must poets strive to create it? And I wonder if you would read for us, speaking of Italy, the poem toward the beginning of your book called The Silent Poem, and then let's talk a little bit about the ways in which you approach style as you were thinking about all of this material and how to form it into one book, and then specifically how you think about style when you're forming individual poems.
Okay, yeah, sure. Silent Poem. Near Assisi, a sign reads, Qui morte San Francesco. The problem with translation is the awkwardness of silence, what cannot be recovered. An expression does not always press towards speech in an ungainly way, the silenzio to hush the museum crowds. The Italians advertise accordi e disaccordi, Allen's suite and lowdown all around Rome. There is no wait to get into a show. In Roma, I eat gelati beside a table of old nuns in white habits. I photograph four police horses down a dark alley in a corner where plaster is ornamentally gummed about a fresco of virgin and child. At last, I feel I have nothing to say. Actually, it's been a sneaking suspicion for a long time, but here it is prominent. There is nothing poor about the Cappella Transitorio, that place near Assisi where St. Francis died. Its smallness alone astounds. And there is a bit of rope. It wants for nothing, not even to get back to the saint. Nobody knows this more than me, says God. Assisi the unbridled, says God. The Spanish steps decline, full of seated tourist girls with their purses between their feet, whose summery pastel and earth tones remind one quickly of the vacant house nearby, adding Keats and Shelley to the pilgrimage, before the thunder breaks, the silence over the Colosseum.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So let's talk about what's going on. That's a very different sort of poem than the poem that you
read
to start the show.
Right.
Will you speak a little bit about does the poem demand the form, or are you working to wrangle it into?
That's interesting. Now I'm fully put on the spot after asking Alice Fulton that question 5 years ago. it strikes me that this poem needs this form. I think precisely because the speaker in the poem is confused in a way that's different than the speaker in the poem. I think the speaker in the poem, Puckard and Chuck, feels very sure of his knowledge of the world in a way that I think that this person doesn't. I'd say probably in both poems there's something that each speaker is contending with is a certain sense of awe. And the one that's more lyrical, the silent poem, that awe somewhat of sort of the mysteries of life and sort of traveling at all, I guess, and sort of being a spectator and traveling and also being a spectator of things and of oneself in a way that one didn't expect sort of determines the sort of broken up nature of that poem. Let me take a look at it again. I think I was happy to end this poem with sort of a breaking of the silence that's sort of determining how this person's speaking. Now, I mean, often in lyrical poetry, silence is the thing, much like in music, so one is always contending against it and finding ways to hopefully break it enough to achieve the poem. And I think, you know, there's somewhat of a giving up of that in this poem, and the speaker says, you know, I have nothing to say, and I suspected that in so many words. But then nature sort of lends itself in to sort of break the silence at the end of the poem. So, you know, we're sort of in cahoots with nature as poets. So I let nature fill in the gaps and win the day, I guess, in that one. So that determined the end. But and I think part of the confusion for the speaker and also the awe of the speaker sort of determined the style of that one.
Mm-hmm.
And made sure that it was different than the other one.
Yeah. And there's something interesting going on in there. You spoke about the silence and the ways in which nature sort of intrudes to overcome. And you set up this really interesting tension. You've called it the silent poem, and then you've broken it through. Whereas the other poem was much prosier. Is that a fair thing to say?
Oh, yeah. It's barely hanging on as a poem, I think.
what do you mean? What do you mean, then?
Well, I think I wanted that one to sort of feel a lot more like a narrative or an essay. And so I tried to, and there was many times when I would pull it out of the manuscript because it didn't seem like a poem in some sort of traditional sense. But I squeezed it back in. I found ways to break enough lines in enough of a jagged way, I guess, to justify at least to myself that it was a poem.
And what was sort of telling you that? Was that this kind of... this style developing naturally, and you've said this naturally is a poem, or was there a real desire thematically or for some other reason that you wanted to wrangle this longer, prosier poem, the one that you read at the beginning, Puckered and Shook on Lower Haight, into the manuscript? What was going on there?
Well, one of the things, I guess, an overlap in themes of the book would be humorously and sometimes reverently and sometimes completely irreverently reinvestigating some like notions of the spiritual life and that sort of thing. And so I was always really happy by the factual, the truly factual moment of the Puckered and Shook poem of this person, Punk Dan, who did actually pass away in Oregon and died mysteriously in a lake and whatnot, but in San Francisco sort of spilling in each morning to this room and blaring Praise God and Pass the Ammunition during the beginning of the Gulf War, and how that was, in some regard, its own, I guess, in some ways, the whole apartment setting was a type of retreat from life, so it had a type of spiritual aspect of it for me, but then also it had this sort of odd, non-monastic in any way, but sort of monastic like community of these like punk guys. So for me, that sort of fit into this one of the themes running through the book, which is just investigating a personal notion of the spiritual life, I guess.
Do you see? You mentioned a retreat from life happens in that poem, and that there's this sort of spiritual aspect of that. Do you then sort of think of the spiritual life as a retreat from life, the factual?
No, I don't see it as a retreat from the factual. I don't know. I think somewhere, I think it was when I was like probably dropping out from the first college that you mentioned. But so around when I was like 18 or so, and I think I got this idea from some book on Hindu philosophy. But just a notion that the other sort of spheres, or what might be called, I guess, in yoga philosophy, like an astral world or something like that, is just a hair's breadth beyond like the physical world. And so... And with practice, I guess you could call it, the physical world could somewhat like fall away and reveal that other one. And that, so what was the question?
If you see the retreat from...
Oh, yeah. So I guess the notion of retreating from what is factual is conditioned by the idea that what is factual might be only a bit of a veil.
Right.
So I guess I don't see it too dichotomy of like retreating too much from life to be spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
Although I think it's always fun to retreat from life to sort of get your grounding again and then come back and face the factual world. And that the factual world itself is a bit of a phony. So that has its, that has its pluses.
Let's look then at, to sort of follow that thread, let's look at your poem, Renunciation, I believe it is. Renunciation on Retreat. And sort of we'll then go on from there.
Sure. So there's a few poems that I think originally when I was trying to form the manuscript, a lot of poems, to go along with what I was just talking about, a lot of poems had the title Something on Retreat or Someone on Retreat.
Yeah.
And now there's only three. There's a Jess on Retreat, a Jennifer on Retreat, and now Renunciation on Retreat. So taking the sort of like the subject of renouncing the world and putting that in focus, I guess. Renunciation on Retreat. I put everything in a sack and carried it down to the lake. The bowl that had been used for cereal tossed in first, then the copy of Geeds the Immoralist. The purple corduroys and the long underwear shirt float the most. Occasionally a white mouth will lift out of the gray water and try to bite the edge of something. The first writing journal sinks no problem. Horticulture and the flowers of Paraguay, written on the bank of a bank receipt, offered up, go down. 80s punk and 60s free jazz say up yours in the modal waves. CDs bob like rainbow lures broken from a line. A spoon carries the murky sky down to the sand and pries it in past the closed-mouthed rocks. Knowing how to free oneself is nothing. It's wanting it that is hard. The gray waters keep bubbling with a breath of increase.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So let's talk a little bit about the ways in which renunciation at the retreat. So there's this notion of the getting rid of the material world and putting it into focus.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned that several of the retreat poems in your stash of loads of retreat poems have fallen away. How did you decide to keep that one for this manuscript and the other two that make it in about the retreat? What is it about the focusing in those that help focus this manuscript and make Bad With Faces what you wanted it to be?
Right. That's a good question. One that maybe I haven't fully considered, so this is neat. I think why these ones stayed is because maybe it goes along with why I ended up keeping the title of the book the way it is. In fact, I had a lot of trouble trying to pick a title for the book. At first it was going to be something about retreat poems, and then I sort of moved away from that, and the title actually I owe to my friend Margaret Dean, who was out at a dinner with her husband Chris, and our friend Stefan and myself, and I was begging everyone to give me a title for the book, and everyone gave up, and then after a while she offered that one up. So, and then I thought, well, how can I make this work with these poems? And then I started getting rid of a lot of poems to maybe start to fit the title a little better. And why these three stayed is, I think, because the speakers in these three poems are having a little bit more issue with the surface of life than the other poems had. The other ones maybe were a little bit too serene.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was kind of playing off the idea, as I did with a lot of the poems that end up in the book, that that the speakers were having trouble with the surface of life or the face of life. That was sort of their way, that they were bad with faces, not necessarily just that they couldn't recognize someone they knew from across a room. And so that's why that one stayed. I kind of really enjoyed that that the speaker of Renunciation on Retreat was just doing this sort of possibly frivolous, possibly not frivolous act of chucking everything they owned into this sort of unforgiving gray lake. And, you know, to tie that back into, I guess, just having fun writing poems in general, and also the journeying theme, I guess. So it was fun because all the objects and the, or most of the objects, it's not always all the objects in a poem that were real, but most of the objects in the poem, I lost once when like a backpack was stolen of mine. So it was fun to occupy that speaker for the duration of the poem.
And recover the...
Yeah, and be the one to sort of chuck them into the lake versus having things being sort of taken from you, which is, you know, always fun with poetry. There's loss, and then you get to turn it into gain.
Into gain. Wonderful. Well, we're going to take a short break. It is the top of the hour. You're listening to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. This is the Living Writers Show. My name is Ashley David, and my guest today is poet Sean Norton. We're talking about his first book, Bad With Faces. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
listening to The Living Writer Show. My name is Ashley David, and my guest again today is poet Sean Norton. We're talking about his book, Bad With Faces. And before the break, we were talking about the ways in which poetry can allow you to sort of take control and retrieve what's taken away and then do with it what you will, which is an interesting way to think about some of the poems in the book in light of the fact that there is a very strong thread of spiritual journey and theology. And
right.
I wonder if you could talk, and I imagine at the heart, and I'd like to ask what the heart is, at the heart of that spiritual journey is a very different sort of premise where the control isn't the individuals, but the control is elsewhere. And if you'd sort of talk about the ways in which those two tensions work together, the sort of taking charge and what's the other half?
Right. I guess an interesting notion to me always in life, and I guess poetically, well, this would have to be the same thing, is just that, you know, it's much more interesting to be aware of what you're not in control of and speak from that place than try to sort of fancifully or poetically in some ways try to control a space that you don't. It was always much more of an interesting enterprise for me to sort of have the speakers of my poems be facing a fact of loss of control, and also somehow, I'm not exactly sure that works always, but somehow being a part of that thing that does or that is in control. So there's sort of a desire to sort of blend into a larger sense of nature or a larger sense of the spiritual. At the same time of sort of relinquishing control, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And how do you see those two things playing out? Because, like, for example, in the poem you just read, Renunciation on Retreat, the speaker in that poem is willingly and willfully giving
away
what was actually taken away. And it's in this context that is sort of renunciation is, you know, something altogether different from even that.
Right.
How do you think about those things together, in terms of as a poet writing poems and just in the world? How do you think people will read or take away from this? What's the message, if you will, if I can be so crass as to ask one?
I don't know. I don't know what message people take away. I guess many of the speakers in the poems seem to be, like, honestly struggling with a notion of like a personal appreciation of awe, whether it be in, like, nature or the spiritual or whatnot, that has an ardent desire to be separate from any sort of maybe conventional notion of that. Or at least I know in my own life, there's sort of a desire to be apart from whatever sort of traditional or dogmatic notions of spirituality that I may have taken on,
right,
or been party to or listened to or something like that as a youth. So I guess that if there's a message, there might be just something that resonates versus, like, a message itself. I'd say if something resonates from that, it's just that that there is some sort of spiritual reality that sometimes haunts the speakers in the poems.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not one that needs to be, like, overly prescribed. I guess I've always been a fan of, you know, you just sort of gravitate towards whatever your heart is gravitating towards already. And then you can, you know, formalize that as much as you want. And I personally practice, like, a type of yoga for spiritual discipline, a type of meditation yoga. Some of the poems for me become metaphors for that. And I don't know if that would be metaphors for that for anyone else as a reader, but certainly I hope it ends up being a metaphor for some aspect of like a spiritual realm or something like that, although that sounds so vague and new agey, but yeah.
No, it's not so vague. I guess the reason I was asking is because there is not a I don't feel that there's any didactic element to the book at all.
Right. Yeah.
And
I don't know if I'm capable of a didactic element.
Well, and yet on the ways in which the book is blurbed and the ways in which people talk about the book, there's always a mention of theology. There's always a mention of spirituality, of the divine.
Right.
I mean, there are a lot of words that are buzzwords for some sort of spiritual journey or quest or message.
Yeah. Right.
And so I was wondering whether that was in fact something that was an intention overt, or rather it's the ways in which the people reading your work are receiving it, because it's very obviously there, but it doesn't feel didactic to me.
Yeah, I think it's more of an intent, just a general intention in my life. And so, and I have a very hard time, and I guess I've stopped seeing this as a handicap in any way, but I have a very hard time sort of separating the arts from like a spiritual discipline of sorts, like, you know, various cultures. That's just accepted.
Well, it's a very strange thing we do in this country, to say poetry is one thing and dance is another and spirituality is another.
Right, right.
Most places I've been outside the country, and even parts of this country, there is a much more holistic approach to this is a practice and it includes these elements. And here we have poetry.
Right, yeah, exactly. I mean, I know, you know, I'm a huge fan of like Tagore, and some of the Indian poets. And so, you know, when I think of Tagore and sort of his all of his students, regarding song and regarding, poetry and regarding music as a spiritual discipline that's going to, lend to them knowledge or, some sort of, even more importantly, experience of you know, higher aspect of themselves, you know. So, and that's, I mean, that's one of the great advantages to poetry, is that, you know, it can clearly not be about anything in the same way that story is, and yet you can fully experience it, and it can sort of put you in, I guess, a sanctioned space for experiencing whatever the poet's introducing at that moment.
Well, I wonder if you would read one more poem for us today. The Return of the Mountain Lion would be lovely.
Sure, yeah, no problem. So, Return of the Mountain Lion.
Yeah, tell us a little, if you want to introduce it, or launch right in, whichever you feel.
No, I can. Maybe I should introduce this one. I think, you know, for this one, again, this is probably a little bit closer to the silent poem in the sense of its, I guess I've been calling it, during the interview, jaggedness of sorts, or lyrical quality of shifts, and probabilities. I think for this one, I was really enjoying, shifting the tone more than anything else. I let that sort of determine the line breaks and sort of where the poem went next. So I'll read it and then maybe we can talk about it some more. Return of the Mountain Lion. I've not looked long enough at the green pea tarnished with boiled egg slither to see how to laugh. Because my words failed it, no one could say beauty. It was a horrible law, not a law really. I can admit that. Don't you watch the game on the corner of 54th and TV? Every Thursday there's another. We call it pain. Every window, that's an exaggeration. Just one read, leave your pain. A glass door, and I opened it for others and read the slogan aloud, knowingly and pointedly, and walked through myself, but nothing changed. Converted to change, all those dollar bills and dollar coins, now hope in a paper cup. I walked through myself for miles until 54th and TV, and realized I'd gone too far and needed to head back the dusty road to the family slaughterhouse.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
There's some really lovely stuff going on in there with respect to the sound, sonically, the way you're playing with the sounds in those lines.
Right, yeah.
That is, it feels a little different from, although there are some similar things with respect to the jaggedness that you mentioned in the poem, the silent poem.
Right.
There's some different sonic things going on in here, and you mentioned tone. What do you mean?
I guess there's something about the tone of that poem that seems like the speaker's intentionally being contrarian, in just what they're announcing because of the absurdity of things. I love the corner. I guess one of the reasons I kept working on the poem is because I couldn't stop being selfishly in love with the corner of 54th and TV.
Yes, I can see why.
As a locale. And I had worked on the poem for a while. It's a relatively small poem, but I had worked on it for a good long time. And once it had the title that, again, this is something that was titled by a friend of mine who said he really liked the poem, but he would only really, really like it if it was called Return of the Mountain Lion, which seemed to somehow fit for him and then it fit for me. Maybe I'm just stealing ideas from friends, but that's fine, I guess. And I guess to loop back to even to the beginning of our conversation, like this notion of journeying and this image of, it was at a friend's wedding, and the reception was, at a place in Seattle, and on the door, literally, you know, there's some decal that just says "Leave your pain," and it seemed like a very funny and beautiful thing that I sort of carried with me for a long time until it had its place in this poem.
Great. Well, we are about out of time, and so it's lovely that you looped right back to the media conversation.
You're welcome,
you did
man.
All my work for me. That's great. It's been a real pleasure to have you on the show, Sean. Thank you very much. You are reading tonight?
Tonight at 7 p.m. at Shaman Drum.
At Shaman Drum on State Street.
Yep, and all new poems, so nothing that I read.
Okay. So come on out. And my guest next week will be former U.S. Poet Laureate Billy Collins.
Hey.
So please tune in. Same time next week, and stay tuned now. The sports report is next. This has been the Living Writers Show on WCBN. My name is Ashley David. My guest has been Sean Norton. We've been talking about his book, Bad with Faces. Thanks for joining us.